You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy won, Candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local 41 and Pipefitters Local 533. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. The Pipefitter powers the engines of industry that keep business thriving in America. They install, maintain, and service any system that involves air conditioning, heating, chemicals, or refrigeration in residential, commercial, or industrial buildings, as well as high-tech clean rooms. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. Welcome to tonight's show. On tonight's show, why do so-called education reforms keep proposing the same failed strategies for education? Blaming teachers, attacking tenure, proposing testing or charters, or outright privatization? What are the strategies based on best practices by teachers that are actually working, and why are they ignored? Find out this week on the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show tonight is called Teacher Wars, the Most Embattled Profession. In the news, the Right to Work bill is on its way to Governor Nixon's desk, and we're in the next fight over fast track and trade. And now for the news.
This is the news from our side, May 15, 2015. Missouri state Republicans shut down debate Tuesday in order to pass a right-to-work measure after Democrats filibustered the bill for more than 8 hours. In return, Senate Democrats plan to shut down all proceedings until the session ends at 6 p.m. Friday. The Republicans are the ones who chose the nuclear option, said Senator Scott Sifton, Democrat, St. Louis County. The rare measure to shut down debate, known as the previous question, has been used in the Senate only 14 times since 1970. It's often used in the House. The Senate's vote of 21-13 to pass the measure, which would bar unions statewide from collecting fees from non-union members, means Democrats will make the passage of a bill renewing health care provider taxes very complicated. Those taxes are used to draw matching payments from the federal government for the state's Medicaid program. Sifton said Governor Jay Nixon could call a special session to pass the renewal measure, but bill handler Senate Dan Brown, Republican from Rolla, noted that a Republican could stall the vote on the measure just like the Democrats did on Tuesday on right to work. I think the Democrats do see we need to do tax renewal, Brown said. It's not to their advantage to blow it up now. The right-to-work measure now heads back to the House, where a similar measure passed 91-64 in February. Both the House and the Senate are shy of the amount needed to override a veto from Nixon, 109 votes in the House and 23 in the Senate. Nixon has said he opposes right-to-work. Any differences between the House and Senate versions of the bill must be reconciled before it is shipped to Nixon's desk. The bill is House Bill 116. To keep up on the latest about the right to work on social media, check out the Facebook group Stop Right to Work for Less in Missouri. They have 5,700 likes so far and could use your support.
And the Huffington Post reports that the Obama administration on Tuesday morning put into motion one of the last major elements of the president's economic agenda, a reform to overtime rules that could result in a pay bump for millions. Fulfilling an executive order issued last year by the president, Labor Department officials have sent a proposal for review to the Office of Management and Budget to expand the number of U.S. workers eligible for overtime pay when they work long hours. The details of the rules will not be released until after the OMB review, but we are eagerly awaiting this by the employers and worker advocates, not to mention overworked Americans, since they will ultimately determine who receives time and a half pay when they work more than 40 hours a week. Obama told the Huffington Post last March, "What we've seen is increasingly companies skirting basic overtime laws, calling somebody a manager when they're stocking groceries and getting paid $30,000 a year. Those folks are being cheated. Under U.S. labor law, certain categories of salaried workers do not qualify for overtime, in particular, well-paid executives and professionals. But under the current rules, last tweaked by the administration of George W. Bush, millions of low- and middle-income workers are also excluded from time-and-a-half pay because their companies are allowed to classify them as management. At the heart of Obama's reform is the so-called salary threshold. Salaried workers who earn less than a certain amount per year are automatically entitled to overtime pay, regardless of whether they're classified as management or not. Right now, that salary threshold is a low $23,660. That means a store manager earning as little as $24,000 could be required to work 80 hours per week with no additional pay. Democratic members of Congress have been pressuring the White House to be aggressive with the expansion. Senate Democrats have recommended a salary threshold of $56,680, which would qualify about half of all salaried workers for overtime pay. Many House Democrats have suggested an even higher threshold of $69,000, which would cover about two-thirds of the salaried workers, according to the Economic Policy Institute.
Citizens Trade Campaign, the leading coalition opposing Fast Track, and the Trans-Pacifica Partnership, President Obama's new trade deal that this followed up to Tuesday's rejection by the Senate of the beginning debate on the measures. It is said on Tuesday the Senate blocked a procedural motion for called closure that would have allowed Fast Track to move forward without a filibuster. Trade bills are traditionally considered in the House first. The reason the TPP proponents wanted the Senate to act on Fast Track first was because they do not have the votes needed to pass the Fast Track in the House, and they expected a strong Senate vote in favor of the Ryan Hatch bill to create the sense of momentum and inevitability around the bill. Obviously, they fell flat on their faces with the first vote being defeated. It was great news, but as expected, quite short-lived. The Senate has since reportedly struck a deal that will allow to pass the closure for Fast Track as early as today, and to vote Fast Track itself possibly as early as next week. Public citizens encourage people to continue urging our senators to oppose both closure and fast track itself, but reinstates that the real fight against fast track is taking place in the House of Representatives.
Migrant farm workers and their allies are organizing in Vermont, calling into question the labor practices of the primary supplier of dairy for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. The Milk with Dignity program is an effort of the group Migrant Justice, which is dedicated to human rights and food justice. Ben and Jerry's buys much of their milk in Vermont from St. Albans Cooperative. Many of the dairy farms that sell their milk to St. Albans use migrant workers on their farms. There are an estimated 1,200 to 1,500 migrant workers on Vermont's 800 dairy farms. There are many problems that our community faces, said Enrique Balcazar, a 22-year-old who came to Vermont to work on a dairy farm. We are excluded from Vermont minimum wage. There are also long work hours. You work, you get up at maybe 2 or 3 a.m., work 12 or 13 hours a day, and maybe don't have a day off, only to return to housing that is not dignified or quality housing. Enrique Balcazar is a former dairy farm worker involved in the campaign. Balcazar says the program would give voice to the farm workers and protect their rights. A spokesman for Ben and Jerry's said that they have taken action for cows through banning use of bovine growth hormone and for chickens through the use of cage-free eggs. They say Ben and Jerry's is a socially responsible company, has to take action on problems in the supply chain. St. Albans Cooperative buys dairy from 430 farms in Vermont and New York. Ben and Jerry's takes pride in being a socially responsible company that responds to criticism from civil society and has pointed to several steps they have already taken to improve labor relations between their dairy suppliers and the suppliers' workers. The Milk with Dignity program is one of several organizations across the country trying to create a more just food supply chain. On the West Coast, organizers are campaigning to boycott Driscoll's Berries in an effort to improve labor conditions on their farms in Mexico and Washington State. Activists drawing attention to labor conditions on farms have been gaining steam in recent years. In January, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers received a presidential medal for extraordinary efforts combating modern-day slavery for drawing attention to the rights of tomato pickers in Florida.
PAI reported from an important convention this week, saying, "We need to reward work, not wealth." A group of union leaders, lawmakers, and big city mayors unveiled a massive grassroots campaign for a progressive agenda to attack income inequality and allied issues. The event was convened by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who provided that particular quote and the movement's initial goals: a $15 hourly minimum wage, paid sick leave and family leave, universal pre-kindergarten and after-school child care, and closure of tax loopholes. The event convened on May 12th. Politicians and union leaders also made it clear that the grassroots movement of workers, students, families, progressives, and their allies would hold presidential hopefuls to that creed, symbolized by the large sign-up poster where all the speakers inked their names. The group, which included Communication Workers President Leo Girard, Steelworkers President Larry Cohn, AFSCME President Lee Saunders, and both teachers' unions presidents, AFT's Randy Weingarten and NEA's Lily Escalon Garcia, said what they are really doing is riding a wave of national economic discontent and outlining achievable goals for advocates. "Our progressive agenda is a story about democracy, opportunity, and fair economy," Cohen declared. "It's about collective bargaining rights for workers, a higher minimum wage, and increasing and not cutting Social Security." and most of all, it's about income inequality. Gerard Cohen and Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat from Oregon, also added opposition to so-called free trade pacts without workers' rights to the agenda. Fair trade for the 21st century ties together what unites us, Cohen commented. Representative Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat from Connecticut, vowed to block fast track in the House. Debate there has not yet been scheduled. I challenge any member of Congress to show us a trade deal that gave us a net increase in jobs and a net increase in wages, Gerard declared. They can't find it. Other items added to the progressive agenda by contributors to the event included strengthening unions and the right to collective bargaining by Representative Keith Ellison from Minnesota, debt-free college education, expansion of Social Security, financing schools, not jails, and second chances at jobs for convicts who served their time, which was added by de Blasio. Accessible and affordable health care and a fairer tax code was suggested by Merkley. Enacting living wage laws and ending racial injustice was added by Representative Barbara Lee from California. And reasonable gun control laws was included by Oakland, California Mayor Libby Shep. And the last one was equal pay for equal work, which was suggested by DeLauro and Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, a Democrat from Texas. The news today has been read by Chris Mann, Jen Zaman, Lon Swearingen, Molly Madden, and I'm Jake White.
I love my teacher because she is super funny and super nice. She makes it fun when I go to school.
She lets me do awesome things.
She protects us.
I love my teacher because she helped me get faster at arithmetic.
I love my teacher because there's so many reasons I love my teacher.
Oh, she's funny.
Because she's funny.
I love my teacher because she works hard.
Because she's patient.
Because she teaches us really good math.
Because she teaches us language arts.
Because she teaches me all of the rules.
I love my teacher because she's thoughtful.
Because she's really sweet and marvelous.
I love my teacher because she has a big heart.
Because she's smart.
I love my teacher because she's patient.
Because he teaches me awesome sports.
She's not afraid to be confused.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Chris Mann, and I'm here with Lon Swearingen. This introductory piece you've just heard was I Love My Teacher Because, which was compiled by WeAreTeachers.com. Tonight, our topic is public education. Lon is reviewing the book, The Teacher Wars, written by Dana Goldstein. Later in the second half, I will be reporting about the second National Network for Public Education Conference, which was held in Chicago, Illinois, on April 25th and 26th. In her book, Dana Goldstein, the book's name is The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Dana explores the origins of today's debates and the key players involved in them, from embattled union leaders to wealthy philanthropists to activists concerned about poverty and inequality. Dana argues that if you look back a century ago, you will find very similar cast of characters. This book covers a lot of ground. The feminization of the teaching corps in the early 19th century, built on the idea that teaching should be a kind Christian missionary work for women. The rise of unions in the 20th century in reaction to the political witch hunts, sexism, and absurdly low pay. Goldstein's policy recommendations for today are included in the book, including ways of increasing race and gender diversity in the classroom and reducing the role and impact of testing. So let's begin. What does the history of education in the book, The Teacher Wars, tell us?
It basically tells us that we're doing the same thing over and over again since public education has come into being, which was around 1830 with Horace Mann and Miss Beecher. This was for teaching children the practical stuff, not the intellectual stuff. And this was what was going on for this period of time. It increased and did other things that we have, what they would call at this time missionary teachers. They would go out, they would get women from the upper echelon to go out west and teach in one school, one house schools that basically had a mission to help these students. And that's what it was about.
You're saying the origins of public education was to have wealthier people teach the poorer teachers? But the concept of everybody gets educated, when did that start?
That meant that everybody gets educated. It's the idea that Horace Mann decided that basically, and he was the first Secretary of Education in Massachusetts and get paid. One of the problems is very simple. How do you pay all these people? And that's why women were being used. There were men that had started this, but what was happening is they needed a way of keeping the cost down, and that's what they did. Now, we've got another chapter in this, which includes Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who basically felt that women should make as much or more money because this was something that was intellectual and that we should have people that can critically think. This is one of the things that is happening. You have the divide. Do we want practical education or do we want people that can critically think? And this was done all over the place right now. This was after the turn of the century. This was in the 1900 in that era of time. Now, if we back up, we also have after the Civil War because of teaching, you had Booker T. Washington with his beliefs about the practical education so that blacks could have jobs. You had W.D. Du Bois, who felt that teachers should have a college education and really have understanding of their subjects. So you have a debate there, too. We've got all these kinds of things going on that really makes for problems because you've got two sides and you got three sides. You got different people wanting different things out of education.
Yes, but it also seems at the same time a natural evolution or evolving of society. So it seems then to me that it's a good thing that we have these conflicts because that is what makes a society go, really, and especially a democratic society.
You would think that would be the way it works, but what happens is more and more become, how can I put it, we are always decentralized, just like you were saying. The federal government, there is nothing written in the Constitution about education. So it has been the states and the municipalities that have done the teaching. This is the way it's been. Up until Johnson became president, and he was, of all things, a classroom teacher. One of the few that have made it up into high office as just a particular classroom teacher in rural Texas. And so he understood it, and this is why he tried with Head Start, and then they had the what was before Teach for America was the Teacher Corps, which was a similar concept of idealized deal of very intellectual and very strong students getting an education and then going out with their particular out into the society to teach. These are the kinds of things which basically went against, again, one of our problems we have. Education is such a mishmash, or however you want to put it, of different ways of becoming a teacher. You even have residency teachers that just go to a particular training thing and get certified to teach. You've got the normal schools, like the ones that came out of the teacher colleges turned into colleges and then major universities. But they started out as just teacher schools, and the idea was is that there was a push again to make teaching a profession with people going to straight to colleges or universities, which wasn't what was going on for a long time. And we still have it, because what we're doing is like Teach for America. It's the same thing. You go out and you get your degree, and then you basically go out and get a job as teaching. And then you find out that the money isn't there and you leave. Or you find out it's too rough. Because one of the things that really came across, and this was in the book, basically the idea is how do you get money into the pockets of teachers? You've got this particular thing that I have right here, a quote from the book, actually, and it goes like this. It's very simple. South Korea teachers' salaries of $55,000 to $155,000 over the course of the career provide 250% of local buying power of what the American teacher does. So you have, and everybody talks about how good South Korea education is internationally. This isn't the only reason for this, but it's one of the major reasons. So we have that. And then you have, like, when we had the deseg problem, we had the desegregation of schools, many black teachers lost their jobs. These are the kinds of things, and they only made 60% of what the top people made in education when they were teaching. These are the kinds of things that went on. We developed unions partially right after the turn of the century in Chicago. They had unions. They were protecting the teacher from the onslaught of politics, and that's basically and being able to get better salaries and benefits and these kinds of things. And that just evolved. And we've had it for a long time. And yet we still have problems dealing with the individual teacher. That's one of our major problems, is because we blame the teacher for achievement or non-achievement, when in reality it's about 7% of what the total picture of a student's life is, as far as nutrition, as far as all kinds of other things. So we have a real problem. We have to deal with on a level that will make us understand that there are people that don't understand education that have gotten into the program, and that's why we have the testing, that's why we have all of this kind of thing going on. It's a major business boom to have standardized tests, and that takes away from education in itself.
On the next, Bioneers.
Everybody knows if you're sitting there with a glass of milk and an eyedropper load of vinegar, so many drops of vinegar and the whole system changes forever. And we're curdling our oceans just now.
Friday morning at 9:30.
This is Wilson, and I'm one of the newest volunteers here at 90.1 FM KKFI. If you would like to get involved in volunteering, go ahead and call Bill at 816-994-7869 or go to kkfi.org/volunteer. Thanks for tuning in to 90.1 FM KKFI, your community radio station.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Chris Mann, your host for this evening, along with Lon Swearingen. Tonight we're discussing the book, The Teacher Wars, by Dana Goldstein. This is the history of America's most embattled profession. Lon, what other information can you give us from this book?
I'm going to give you a quote about money. because money seems to be the thing. Here it goes. Consider this. My first full-time job, this is Dana Goldstein saying it, in a magazine journalism paid $21,000. I thought my friends who were public school teachers were rich. 5 years later, at 27 years old, I was earning three times my starting salary. Meanwhile, a New York City public school teacher with my same level of education, a bachelor's degree, got a raise of less than $5,000 over the first 5 years of her career, from $45,530 to $50,153. This is what it's about. There may be a starting salary that looks good, but then you can raise your a little bit by going to school, but how much schooling costs takes the money, how much are you going to make up that, and things like this. So, yes, the teacher wars is here, and the idea is that we need to realize what is happening to our teachers.
So then what Dana is saying is that the conditions teachers work under and their payment is quite influential to keeping teachers in the field.
Right.
So what do you feel is the most important messages coming from this book for educators and community members alike to take away from this conversation? What do you think was most important in her book?
I'm going to quote again something, just the bottom line on it. And then I'm going to quote John Dewey, by the way. If we accept the limitations of our decentralized political system, we can move toward a future in which sustainable and transformative education reforms are needed from the ground up, not imposed from the top down. They will be built more upon the expertise of the best teachers than on our fears of the worst teachers. This is how we will achieve an end to our teacher wars. And now I want to quote one of our greatest teachers that I consider great, and that's John Dewey. And here we go. It is advisable that the teacher should understand and even be able to criticize the general principles upon which the whole education system is formed and administered. He is not like a private soldier in an army, expected merely to obey, or like a cog in a wheel, expected merely to respond to the transmit external energy. He must be an intelligent medium of action.
Okay, so you're saying teachers are really not spitting back information to students, but really teaching students how to affect change in the world and in society.
Right, and the idea is this is what why we need critical thinking in our school. What I want to tell you is why this bottom-up thing is so important and why teachers are important. There's an interesting mantra that people with disabilities have, and I have a disability, and it's what nothing about us without us. And what we've been doing in the profession of education is leaving out the ones that are doing the education. And they should be the number one group that has to say, because they are the people, just like it is, the rubber meets the road.
Okay, Lon, we're coming near the end of our time. And I just wanted to ask you one last question. How do you think, or how does Goldstein think, that teachers can regain respect and admiration so that people want to stay in the profession? And also, since there's only 24% men in the profession, What do you think needs to happen before more men go into the profession and also women feel that this is a secure job?
What I'm about to say is about a quote from the book, The Teacher Wars, that gives an idea that if we use it, it may help us become what we want to become. So here it is. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, so she said, came to the realization that without a social movement of their own, teachers' movement, the cause of women's rights in America would not move forward. In planning the Seneca Falls Convention, she recruited not only female activists, but also important male abolitionists, including Frederick Douglass, and a number of influential Quakers. The extraordinary manifesto that came out of Seneca Falls was called the Declaration of Sentiments. It borrowed the structure of the vocabulary of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident: consent of the governed to argue to favor women's suffrage, equal treatment before the law, regardless of sex, and equal access to marital property and child custody. And if teachers want to have respect, they need to align with those that are out there, parents, administrators, and other people that aren't involved in schools.
Yes, and maybe other social justice issues,
right,
that come up. And that means to have solidarity with other people in their struggles.
Right.
For teachers to gain admiration.
Correct.
And justice.
And I believe that wholeheartedly. I really like the book. The book has a lot to say. There are some critical points in it. And what I've read and what I've said about things came from the book. It wasn't from an outside.
Okay, well, thank you, Lon, for tackling such an awesome read. And can you join me for the second half of the show?
Sure can.
Okay, thanks again, Lon.
Thank
Teacher
you.
Wars by Dana Goldstein.
Correct.
Okay, thanks so much.
Opting out on Broadway, from Babylon to Buffalo. Parental anger up in Albany. They chased the senators to the stop at Ramapo. They tore the Common Core in Plattsburgh and threw the test into Oyster Bay. The governor lost his clout the day they opted out. Schools could live another day. I've seen them opting out on Broadway. They gave the finger to each lake. They slammed on Pearson there in Syracuse. They never made a truce with children's lives at stake. They all refused the test in Lockport. And Rockville Center rocked with rage. Assemblymen took flight. Parents showed their might, shredded booklets page by page. You know they opted out on Broadway, but those refusals
much more. It's 'cause America took note of this and forced the government to kill the Common Core. When parents stand up for their children, how can opponents still survive? We'll tell the world about the way we opted out and keep our public schools alive.
Welcome to the second half of the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Chris Mann. The introductory music you've just heard was Bald Piano Guy singing They Opted Out on Broadway. Tonight we've already heard that changes in public education should be made from the bottom up rather than the top down. Author Dana Goldstein suggests that teacher organizations become united with parents and community members to effect change. The Network for Public Education Conference, held on April 25th and 26th in Chicago, assembled 600 unionists, public education activists, and parents combined to attend workshops and dialogue about change. The biggest news was that over 155,000 parents had opted their children out of taking New York's end-of-the-year standardized tests. The opt-out option was initiated by parents, not teacher unions, as you might expect. The Network for Public Education is chaired by Diane Ravitch. Ravitch was once a supporter of the Bush administration. She has since renounced the educational policies of the Bush administration and is now considered one of the foremost educational historians in the world. Diane moderated two keynote sessions that I attended. One was with the national presidents of the AFT, Randy Weingarten, which is American Federation of Teachers, and the NEA International President, which is the National Education Association President, Lily Eccleson Garcia. The second keynote that I attended was a one-to-one conversation with Karen Lewis, President of Chicago's Chicago Teachers Union, who is recently recovering from a brain tumor. The conference hosted workshops with activists from all areas of the country. It was impossible to attend them all. Conference activists networked into the wee hours of the morning. There were workshops on charter schools, organizing public school advocacy groups, social justice workshops, and workshops featuring special education issues. To hear more extensively the audio and video tapes, go to www.networkforpubliceducation.org. In closing, we'll listen to G2 Brown, a community organizer for the Kenwood community in Chicago. He will equate that there's a connection between racism and school closings. Our final audio will be Lily Garcia and Randy Weingarten dialoguing about teacher tenure and the future of unions. I'd like to leave us after the audio tapes, a quotation from Diane Ravitch. She says, "Testing is not a substitute for curriculum and instruction. Good education cannot be achieved by a strategy of testing children, shaming educators, and closing schools." Thank you for listening.
So I want to talk about a reason to fight. What is education? You know, to every educator in this room, you know that it's, and every student and every parent, you know that it's not just going to school so that you can get a good job. I was taught that education is inspiration and information that prepares you to make your way in the world. And for every teacher, you know it's not about what you put inside of a child's head, but it's that moment of self-discovery. It's that moment when that child realizes, oh, I can do it, and then their possibilities expand. That's education. And the information just helps to develop what that child has already discovered. And we have to ask ourselves, is that what's going on in the United States today? Is that what's happening in our schools? Are our young people being inspired? Are they being given the space to believe that they can be anything, that they can change anything, that when they look at problems in their communities, they see opportunities? Or are our children being prepared to be profited upon? Are our children being prepared to be inmates? See, there's something that's happening in all of our names. The same value system that used to take African-American babies and use them as alligator bait. The same value system that used to lynch people, that used to burn them alive in front of mobs. This is the same value system that can strangle Eric Garner in the middle of the street and then say somehow he deserved it. That same value system says it's okay to shoot a 12-year-old boy in Ohio and say somehow he had it coming. Or somehow Mike Brown deserved to get gunned down in the middle of the street like an animal. That same value system says it's okay to close schools when you know that the result on receiving schools is disaster. I don't want to make anybody mad in this room, but they're colonizers. Right. They're colonizers. So when we live in communities and we have no say-so over the institutions that we pay taxes to fund, we are being colonized. When we live in communities and we have a board that parents pass out, a parent from Stagg Elementary School fainted while she's telling them, please don't close my school. Please don't send my child to this school. It's not safe. She hits the ground. They pick her up and they cart her out and they keep it moving.
We will win these lawsuits, but that's not winning the battle. Winning the battle means we have to be out there saying, how do we attract and retain great teachers for the kids who need them most? And that means we have to have tenure. How do we make sure that teachers have the right to speak and to take risks? We have to make that argument with the public so the public understands tenure is a children's right. And when we do that, we will win.
Yes, and it's not lost on any of us that the bizarreness of celebrities waking up one morning and saying, I want to make the world a better place for boys and girls by making it easy to fire teachers. You know? And we won't tell you who's funding their organization. Coincidentally. So as we're out there fighting for what it truly means to teach and what it means to learn, as we're out there saying, as you talk about the test score gap between affluent and poor children, why isn't anyone talking about the resource gap, the service gap, what these kids have and these kids don't have? It is the most insidious distraction to say these kids do so well on a standardized test because they must have good teachers. And these kids must have bad teachers. I taught for years in a homeless shelter. It was the best teaching gig ever. It really was, because in the family homeless shelter in Salt Lake City, Utah, where diversity means you found a Presbyterian, you had whole family services. They had a one-room schoolhouse, and these were the kids whose parents were afraid to have them leave the secure facility because they were running away from scary people, domestic violence, drug dealers. We didn't ask questions. We said, if you won't let your kid get on the school bus that will take you to the local public school, then we will send a public school teacher here to the shelter. And I got to be that teacher. And I didn't have a school nurse. I had a school doctor. There was a little medical clinic. We had a dentist. We had social workers that worked with the whole family, helping with mental health issues, helping with housing and job placement.
It was an amazing array of services. I got to see what it really looks like to serve that whole child, serve that whole family. When I look at what has happened to students in our public schools in the most challenging neighborhoods, in poverty, kids that face discrimination every time they walk out their doors, and to see that someone is hyperventilating over the test score gap and not spending one breath on why don't these kids have a school nurse? Why don't they have a clean, healthy building? Why is their computer lab, their brand new computer lab, only used for testing? And this all comes back to the tenure issue. You thought I forgot it. This all comes back to the tenure issue because when we stand up and we start saying, and where are the services and supports for these kids? We're told, you know, if they just had good teachers, they wouldn't need all these things. It wouldn't matter that they had 45 third graders in a class. And so it is an excuse. If they can blame a teacher, which, by the way, is really, really cheap, you blame enough teachers, if we could just fire those teachers, then we wouldn't have to worry about giving these kids what they need. And they get a twofer. Because they go, and why can't we fire those bad teachers? Because their union protects them. So you have to get rid of the union to get rid of bad teachers. And if you get rid of bad teachers, then just on, you know, on wishing it so, all these kids will close the test score gap because that really means achievement. And it all follows this insidious logic. That is why we're under attack. And yet we're seeing more and more folks questioning that line of logic. They really do have critical thinking skills out there. Moms and dads are going, now wait a minute, but my kid's in a class with 40 third graders, and my kid doesn't have what they need, and my kid's teachers and that paraprofessional, and sometimes the custodian, they're taking money out of their own pocket to get, like, the science fair project. And lucky us, they canceled the science fair because it wasn't, you know, it cut into test prep time. So all of those, the people who walk into those school buildings, the moms and dads and grandmas, they are starting to get it. We see the public waking up because they're hearing your voice. They can hear us till we're hoarse. And they go, oh yeah, but they're the ones that wake up every morning to protect bad teachers. You can't believe them. When they hear it from you, how many of you know the names of the kids that we're talking about? You know the names of your students. You know the names of the families. That's what's making all the difference in the world. The phone calls I get on can I get fired come from teachers who are asking me. I'm getting a direct question from a mom and dad about their rights to opt their kid out of the test they think is hurting them. Can I get fired if I just answer their question? It depends on what state you live in. The answer is yes, you can. These are not teachers who are afraid that they're going to be fired or not get due process because they're not doing a good job. They're afraid that they are really helping kids and helping them with a social justice heart, and because of that, they might be losing their jobs. So we know that tenure is something that if they can scare us into silence by saying we could fire you, we could destroy your union, that they win. We aren't going to let them win.
I love my teacher because she is super funny and super nice.
She makes it fun when I go to school.
She lets me do awesome things.
She protects us.
I love my teacher because she helped me get faster at arithmetic.
I love my teacher because there's so many reasons I love my teacher.
Oh, she's funny.
Because she's funny.
I love my teacher because she works hard.
Because she's patient.
Because she teaches us really good math.
Because she teaches us language arts.
Because she teaches me all of the rules.
I love my teacher because she's thoughtful.
because she's really sweet and marvelous.
I love my teacher because she has a big heart.
Because she's smart.
I love my teacher because she's patient.
Because he teaches me awesome sports.
She's not afraid to be goofy.
Sometimes she calls herself Miss Bananas.
I just love her.
She makes me feel very warm and fuzzy inside, and whenever I'm around her, I feel very safe and protected.
Because she's sweet.
Because she's awesome.
She's cool.
I love my teacher.
I love my teacher.
I love my teacher.
I love my teacher.
My teacher is just the greatest teacher ever.
I love my teacher because she loves me.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for May 14, 2015, Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast. Saturday, May 16th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9:15 for speaker. Kansas City, Kansas Community College, 7250 State Avenue, room 2325/26, bottom floor of Jewel Building. Speakers are Stan Fraunfelter and Luis Ruiz. RSVP to scottmackey08@yahoo.com. Worker Justice Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, May 18th, 5 to 8 p.m., El Centro. Support home health care workers. Deliver a message to the governor, May 19th and 20th. Governor's Mansion, Jeff City. Contact Jobs with Justice, 816-805-2385. Okay. KC Consumer Adversary Board Meeting on the Signs of Abuse in Children and Adults. Thursday, May 21st, 10 to 11:30 a.m. Kauffman Foundation Center, 4800 Rock Hill Road, KCMO. For more information, call 816-453-4424. City Council Hearing on Raising Minimum Wage to a Living Wage. Thursday, May 21st at noon, on the 10th floor of City Hall.
Thanks, Molly. And that's been tonight's show. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, it is 100 years ago, socialist-dominated Mocan labor. It's the history of a socialist party and women battle sexual harassment at Ford Chicago. I have been your engineer tonight. I'm Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.